And good morning, everyone, and welcome to the HTI-1 Proposed Rule Task Force meeting. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and I'd like to thank you for joining us today. On behalf of ONC, I'd like to thank the co-chairs and the task force members for dedicating your time and expertise to provide a recommendation on our proposed rule. Today's meeting is of the full task force. The task force members are divided into three groups who will generally meet on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday each week during the public comment period. All of our task force meetings are open to the public and your feedback is welcomed, which can be typed in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting or can be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled toward the end of our meeting this morning. I'd like to begin roll call of our task force members. When I call your name, please indicate you are here. And I'll start with our task force co-chairs, Stephen Lane.
Hello, good morning.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning and welcome.
Madel Briggs Melanson.
Good morning.
Hans Spindyke.
Good morning.
Hannah Galvin.
Good morning.
Raj Gavarti. Audie Gunlopoli. Jim Durgis. Elaine Johansson.
Jim Durgis here. I didn't hear you.
Thank you, Jim. Hung Lu.
Good morning.
Meg Marshall. Anna McAllister. Glenn McDonald. Devin McGraw.
Good morning, I'm here.
Aaron Meir. Oh, thanks, Devin. Aaron Meir. Elio Oliveira.
Good morning, everybody.
Ike Lama Ocean Kenton.
Good morning, all.
Nari Sundar Rajan.
Good morning, here.
Bill Sutherland.
Good morning.
And Cheryl Turney. All right, thank you everyone. And now please join me in welcoming Stephen Lane and Steve Eichner for their opening remarks.
Well, again, thank you all for joining us this morning. It's really a treat to kick off a new task force with so many friends and dedicated high-tech members, as well as the ONC team. We have a lot of work to do. Obviously, we've broken the work into three subsets, and most of you have been assigned to one of the subgroups to meet together over the next couple of months. A few people have volunteered for more than one work group, which is welcome, and a couple of you have volunteered for all three, which we really, really appreciate the input and the thoughtfulness here. There's just a lot of meaty substance in this proposed rule, and I know that ONC has asked for a lot of specific input, so we'll have lots of opportunity to dig deep, to provide that input and likely impact the final product that we anticipate come out later this year. So again, thank you all for being here. Steve, you want to add to that?
There's not much to add. You did a wonderful job. I'd just like to kind of reemphasize or restate my gratitude for all task force participants. We do have an awful lot of stuff to go through, but it is really, really interesting. And I hope we can provide some valuable input back to ONC and our federal partners and really continue to make a difference in improving health information exchange and interoperability, and look forward to the challenge.
So I think we are going to have some review here of our charge and our timelines, and then dig right in to the decision support interventions and predictive models space. We thought that it would make sense to take advantage of having the entire group together. This is really a new domain for the ONC to be making rules about. And the team from ONC has come to get us started on that. We actually have quite a lot of material to cover, the background for that. And we're hoping to get through that. Certainly if people want to dig in and ask questions, that'll be fine. We gave ourselves plenty of time to do that. And then the that group two, the Wednesday group, will be picking that up and developing the specific feedback about that. And I believe, Mike, that's scheduled to, that discussion will continue tomorrow, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And this is Steve Leitner, just to add on to that, if for some reason we don't have sufficient time today for questions and answers, we will continue the Q&A component during tomorrow's meeting. Everyone, again, it's a public meeting. Both task force members and the public are welcome to attend.
I think that's a really good point, which is to say that we have laid out the schedule for all of the work groups, noting which topics will be discussed in which meetings. So even though you might have committed yourself to the Thursday group, if there is a topic that's being discussed on a Tuesday or Wednesday that is near and dear to your heart, you're certainly going to be welcome to join and serve as a task force member with all the rights and responsibilities thereof during a meeting of a work group other than the one to which you've been assigned. We do hope that people will show up for their assigned work group, simply so that we have the full input of the group and have a quorum for those meetings.
And as an add-on to that, the ONC team has worked diligently to make a lot of information available through the Google Sheets interface, with things broken out by subgroup or by task force group. Everybody does have access, both read and write access, to all of the material for all subgroups. We do ask that if you make a comment on a subgroup worksheet, that you also then attend the relevant meeting for that particular topic, regardless of subgroup, so that if there's a question or additional information needed, you're available to help fill in the gaps. Thanks.
And then one other point, just to help with any confusion, you and I have done this before. I'm happy to go by Stephen. I think Steve Eichner is happy to go by Ike, just so we all know whom we're speaking to. And perhaps in the written materials, I think, Ike, that you're happy to go as Steve, and I go by Stephen, just again, so that we can keep that straight.
Absolutely. And both Stephen Lane and I, Steve Eitner, are always available via email and like to help answer questions, chat, do whatever we can to help you, the task force, help everybody produce better content.
So with that introduction, Mike, do you want to walk us through get us to the charge and the timeline so we can walk through it?
Sure. Can we go to the next slide? Next slide.
There we go.
Here we're going to. Yeah. Go ahead, Stephen. Take it away.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think we went through the roster for role taking, but we did want to give everybody a brief chance to introduce yourselves, where you're from, and what your specific interest is in the work of this task force. So we can just run down the list. Steve, you want to start us off?
Gladly. My name is Steve Eitner. I'm the health IT lead for the Texas Department of State Health Services. My role at DSHS includes working across programs and with external parties on a wide range of activities related to health information exchange. I've also got subject matter expertise in rare diseases and the benefits of health information exchange for small populations.
And I'll go next, and then we'll run alphabetically from there. Stephen Lane, I'm a practicing family physician and clinical informaticist with a deep interest in interoperability, privacy, and information security. And I, for 6 or 7 months now, serve as the chief medical officer at Health Gorilla. Madel?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Madel Briggs-Melanson, and I am a practicing emergency physician, but I also serve as the chief for health equity, diversity, and inclusion for the UCLA Health System, where I actually provide the oversight and strategic planning for all initiatives that actually advance equity and justice within our organization and communities. My other area of expertise is the intersectionality between building equitable infrastructures and health IT in order to support health justice, as well as data justice. And lastly, I do serve as the co-chair for the full high tech committee. So very happy to be on this work group. Thank you.
Thanks, Madel. Hans?
Hello, my name is Hans Buitendijk. I am with Oracle Health, Director of Interoperability Strategy, focusing on anything interoperability from standards to regulations. In that capacity, I'm active within the EHRA, and where we will be talking a lot about these topics as well. Active in HL7 to develop the variety of standards that are referenced, and in some network activity as well. So looking forward to the discussions. I guess I am one of the ones with an interest in all three, so we'll attend them all. And upfront apologies, there might be some background noise when I talk at times. There is some construction going on nearby, but I will try to minimize that.
Thank you, Hans. Hannah?
Hi, I'm Hannah Galvin. I am a practicing pediatrician and the Chief Medical Information Officer for Cambridge Health Alliance, a public academic health system in the Boston area. I am also the co-founder and co-board chair of SHIFT, the Independent Healthcare Task Force for Equitable Interoperability. And in that capacity, I am very specifically interested in the RFI around granular data segmentation and the patient-restricted ability to restrict data transmission in this rule, but I am interested in multiple aspects of this rule, including the information blocking pieces and the decision support pieces as well. And in my capacity in SHIFT, we'll certainly be commenting as well. So did want to sort of call that out. So looking forward to this very much.
Thank you, Hannah. I don't think we have Raj here or Adi. Is that true? Okay. Jim Gerges, are you with us?
Yes. Thank you, Stephen. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks. I'm Jim Gerges, a physician internist and trained in infectious diseases as well. I'm the Chief Health Information Officer for HCA, have been for about 10 years now, and have been along for a few years on this ride with high tech. And I'm very interested in going deep and making sure that what's in the rule and what our comments are really serve the goals of reducing provider burden, increasing patient access, and true interoperability. So I'm delighted to be on this task force.
Thanks, Jim. I don't see Elaine from FDA. Hung Lu?
Yes. My name is Hung Lu, and I'm the Associate Professor of Pathology at UT Southwestern Medical Center, and I serve as the Director of Clinical Pathology for Children's Health, a pediatric healthcare system in North Texas. And so I bring the perspective of a laboratorian, and also I always keep in mind the pediatric point of view to all these standards and regulations. And so my special interest is in laboratory data interoperability, and how we can use big data to improve healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't think Meg Marshall from VA is here. Anna. You might be on mute, Anna.
Oops, sorry about that. Yes, I was on mute. Hi, I'm Anna McAllister, and I work as an independent consultant focused on patient health technology and ways to inform data use, data access, data governance with the perspectives and interests of patients. I helped start a patient hacker movement in the type 1 diabetes space, and have done a lot of advocacy and work focused on data access, interoperability, data standardization, and making it possible for individuals to be able to use data streams and data for the things that matter most to them. In addition, I've done a lot of advocacy and participation and discussions and policies around the use of real-world data for health research, as well as the development of better digital biomarkers that to replace blood-based biomarkers.
Wonderful. I don't see Clem with us. Devin?
Hi, everyone. I'm Devin McGraw. I'm the lead for data stewardship and data sharing at Invitae, which is a clinical genetic testing company. Came to Invitae after they purchased a startup that I co-founded called Citizen, which helps patients leverage their rights to get their health data under both HIPAA and the information blocking rules and to then have that data under their control. Was formerly acting chief privacy officer at ONC and also worked at OCR as the deputy director for health information privacy. So all things HIPAA. Many, many things in this role are interesting to me, like others. Similar to Hannah, I'm very interested in the data segmentation and right of restriction issues, although I tend to look at those issues through the policy lens. I have less knowledge about the technical pieces, so I'm excited to have so many experts on those aspects of it on our as part of our work group. And then I'm also very interested in the information blocking provisions, and particularly around the incentives to utilize TEFCA. Many, many questions I have about that. So I'm looking forward to that discussion too. Thank you.
Thank you, Devin. And I think Clem has joined us now. Clem, you want to introduce yourself? You're on mute.
Okay, I've joined you now.
Thank you. Great. Thank you, Stephen. You want to tell people where you come from?
Oh, sure. I am the Chief Health Data Standards Officer at National Library of Medicine. And my history has been a deep interest in electronic medical records and the standards needed to support them.
Wonderful. Thank you. Eliel.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Eliel Oliveira. I'm the Director of Research and Innovation at the Bell Medical School, which is at the University of Texas at Austin. And I lead our health informatics team, where we manage several informatics projects related to social determinants of health, health equity, disease surveillance, population health, And of course, most importantly, anything that has to do with data aggregation for research purposes is part of our purview. I also serve as a board member for the Health Information Exchange in Central Texas called Conexus. And I'm the PI, the principal investigator in one of the LEAP projects, ONC LEAP projects, which right now is working on a closed loop social services referral system. And I have been in previous LEAP projects in the past. Thank you for having me.
I must say the expertise in the room is pretty overwhelming. Deo?
Hi, good morning, all. I am the Chief Medical Officer at Pegasystems, which, you know, focuses on low-code platform technology powered by AI and workflow automation. And my background, I'm boarded in internal medicine. With extensive knowledge in the payer and provider space. I worked as a medical director for a large health payer here in the States. And I also worked as a healthcare consultant. And so I have a keen focus on high quality and cost-efficient care delivery models, as well as a deep expertise and proficiency in hospital medicine and physician alignment and accountability for delivery of quality metrics. My keen focus in terms of joining this committee is really because I'm a staunch patient advocate and also duly a provider advocate. So my hope is to decrease the provider burden as I still practice, and there's a lot of things that we can improve upon still, and also data interoperability as well as information sharing and health equities are also my passion. So I look forward to working with you all and gaining some insights from you and your experience as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Naresh?
Thank you, Steven. Good morning, everyone. This is Naresh, and I'm currently serving as Chief Data Officer for Sync Health, a statewide health information exchange for the state of Nebraska and state of Iowa. My areas of expertise relies on interoperability and specifically provider, payer, public health, and patient data exchange across the states and boundaries with proper data governance and policies in place. With respect to interoperability, we work with on a daily basis exchange of millions of records, which actually complies to US CDI core data standards, and really looking forward for the conversation around clinical decision support systems and other topics. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I, Phil, you're next.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Glad to be part of the group. Phil Sutherland, Director of Healthcare Solutions at Yardi Systems. We have about 500,000.
I want to see whether there's, I had a really interesting discussion
about kind of long-term post-acute care space. And I have a software development background. I had a startup back in late 2000s that was acquired by Yardi. So generally interested in how this rule will impact the overall interoperability landscape, and particularly interested in the algorithmic transparency rule.
Wonderful. And I don't think Cheryl is with us this morning. Mike, can we do a brief introduction of the ONC staff who is supporting us here?
Sure, I think everybody's on. We have several people, their program leads that are supporting each of the groups. I think group one is Dan Healy. And Dan, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Hi, good morning, everyone. I'm Dan Healy. I'm a policy coordinator in ONC's Office of Policy and Compliance Administration Branch. My background is in health systems research primarily. So great to be with you all today and looking forward to the discussions and the conversation. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Dan. And for group two, Sarah McGee is going to be supporting that group. Sarah, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, good morning, everybody. I'm Sarah McGee. I'm on the Regulatory and Policy Affairs team. My background, I'm an attorney by training, but I've been working in policy for quite a while. And many years ago, I actually worked for Texas Department of State Health Services when it was HHS. So anyway, it was nice to meet all of y'all. I'm looking forward to this task force and working with everyone.
Great, thanks, Sarah. And we have two ONC folks helping us with group three, that being Michael Witte and Dustin Charles, if you'd like to introduce yourselves.
Sure, I'm Michael Witte. I'm in the strategic coordination group at ONC. I'm an epidemiologist and informaticist by background. I was the program lead for the contract that developed the draft EHR reporting, now insights, condition measures. So I'm very interested in that. And also have a background on CDS coordination and development. So I'm interested in everything.
You're in good company. And I don't see Dustin on the list. Am I missing him?
Maybe Dustin's not on at the moment, but he is one of the program leads for group three. Of course, there are many other people, including myself, that support this task force and the HITECH in general. And we're going to meet a couple of the ONC presenters further along in our agenda. So I'll turn it back to you, Stephen.
Great. Well, again, thank you everyone for taking the time. A little more than 20 seconds per, but just amazing expertise and insight. And I'm looking forward to our discussions. With that, let's dive in, Steve and Ike, unless you have something else you want to add.
I've got nothing to add.
Great. All right, so Ike, do you want to take us through our charge and timelines?
Absolutely. Let's go to the next slide. So as we've got an overarching charge, which is looking at evaluating and making comments upon the broad NPRM. And then we've got specific charges going through looking at specific ONC proposals, such as reviewing all certification criterion within the certification program, looking at establishing a new baseline version of the US CDI, shifting from version 1 to version 3, and then looking at implementing the EHR reporting program with some new insights. And all those charges are broken, kind of broken out and apply a little bit differently to the different subgroups, again, depending upon what's in each subgroup's portfolio. Next slide. This, again, continues the specific charges looking at recommendations on a range of ONC's proposals, looking at things like electronic case reporting, computer decision support, API interfacing, FHIR interfacing, looking at new patient restriction criterion, looking at additional assurance criterion and maintenance of certification components, and then looking at several requests for information on program standards and information blocking. Next slide, please. We can go through and kind of, as I mentioned earlier, these are broken out by the different groupings. So what's on the slide right now is those specific charges that are for group one, looking at information blocking, looking at an RFI for additional exclusions for offering health IT, looking at information blocking and exceptions under TEFCA, looking potentially at additional TEFCA reasonable necessary activities related to information blocking that would allow or permit information not to be shared, looking at additional information about information blocking and the infeasibility exceptions to keep reviewing and revising the existing conditions for uncontrollable events, and looking at third parties seeking a modified use, looking at a new condition for a manner for an exception exhausted, and again, another RFI looking at health information technology capabilities for data segmentation and user patient access and information blocking. Next slide, please. Looking at group two, looking at DSI and predictive models, looking at electronic case reporting, looking at the ONC certification criterion for health IT, and discontinuing themed year additions, in other words, a shift from a methodology that uses, say, the 2015 edition to another methodology for identifying what providers need to be compliant with at what point in time, a requirement for health IT developers to update their previously certified HIT. Again, tied a little bit looking at that consistency measure so that providers can easily understand what version they have and what version they need to be using to be compliant with existing systems. And again, looking at group three, focused on ONC health IT certification program updates, looking at insight condition and maintenance of certification, the US CDI standard we mentioned earlier, looking at updates to the CCDA companion guides, looking at modifications to standardized APIs for patient and population services, making recommendations regarding FHIR US Core Implementation Guide, STU, and then several other requests for information. Next slide. we've divided the larger task force into three different work groups or three different subtask force.
Hey, Ike, you want me to share your voice and we can throw it back?
Sure.
Yeah, good. So I do want to point out that Cheryl Turney has joined us. Apparently she was able to get in by phone on the public line, but they're trying to get her switched over to be a panelist. But Cheryl, welcome. You are one of the lucky folks who got assigned to group one, and you heard what the specific charge for that group is. You can see we tried to spread the groups out so that they're roughly the same size. But as we said, you're welcome to hop between them if you want to do some additional work. You can see here group two. Again, I'm not going to read the names, but there are the assignments there, as well as group three. As we mentioned, Ike and I are going to try to attend all the meetings. Hung has agreed to lead group three. We really appreciate, especially as we pull together the recommendations toward the end. Next slide.
Can I just ask on that, Steve? If we do have an interest in attending the other group meetings, will we be receiving invites for all groups, or do we need to reach out to you as co-chairs to receive that information?
Mike, how do you want that to be done?
Yeah, we have not sent invites to everybody for all groups. If you're interested in participating in another group, whether it's a one-off meeting or more, you know, you can email me and we'll make sure you're added to a specific meeting. Just let us know.
And I got a message from Jim Gerges that he wanted to be on group two as well. So maybe, Mike, if you guys can facilitate that, that would be great.
Sure.
Excellent. Yeah.
This is like, we didn't email invitations for everybody for each meeting is that we didn't want to overwhelm or ask too much. There are a quite large number of meetings across three task groups or task forces or subgroups over the next several months. Again, everyone is welcome to participate in any. Please let Mike know if you're interested, and I'm sure that they would be happy to send you invitations for one or all of the task force member meetings. They are also available on the high tech and ONC calendar of events.
So what we're going to do next is go through the week by week timeline that we have proposed. I suspect we'll be able to keep to this, but there's always flexibility built in. All of this culminates with our presentation to the HITAC on Thursday, June 15. And what we've heard is that that's going to be an in-person meeting. So we will be well known to one another by then, and it'll be great to be able to get together in person for the delivery of the recommendations. So the ONC team, do you guys want to quickly run us through the timeline slides?
Sure, I'm happy to. Can we go to the next slide? And I'll just note that all these documents are on our website for any member of the public that wants to follow along to any specific task force meeting. Today, the full task force is meeting, as you can see, and then group two, which will meet on Wednesdays, except for one of the meeting dates that meets on Wednesdays. And you can just kind of see the topics assigned for each group. Group three will meet on Thursday. And so what we did was we just broke this out by week. So it's pretty easy to follow along. We can go to the next slide. And this is, you know, getting into May, the three groups meet. And keep going, please. You can see all the topics that were on the slides that I went through previously are all kind of on this list. And so the plan is to get through all the topics pretty much by the end of May. So we can go to the next slide. As you can see, this is a very fast moving task force because it has to operate within the public comment period. So we have a lot to get through in a little bit of time. When we get to the week seven, that's when we did send meeting invites to the full task force. All task force members got those invites. if group one, two, or three needs to meet, you know, one more time, then we, there, you know, we could turn one of those full task force meetings into a specific group meeting or a combination. So, but the goal was to get wrapped up during week seven into week eight. It would be great if we could have all the materials, all the slides and recommendations ready by meeting 21, which is on June 8th. We have a kind of a placeholder meeting number 22 on June 13th, if needed, but that's cutting it awfully close for the recommendations to be delivered to the HITAC. And as Stephen mentioned, we are planning an in-person HITAC meeting in Washington, D.C., and we'll publicize that on our website. The HITAC members will be sent an email probably this week once we finalize our logistics, which we're very close to doing so. And we can go to the next slide. And Stephen and Ike, I'll turn this back to you.
Thank you so much. So want to open it up to any questions or comments from the members before we dive into the material itself.
Steve, this is Hans. Maybe one question on just the logistics on gathering our feedback, the spreadsheets, otherwise, how we plan to use that maybe now or later in the meeting so that we know where to look, where to update, and how far we can go.
Really good question, Hans. Thank you for that. So I think you've all been sent the link to the spreadsheets. Is that right, Mike?
Yes, that was part of their homework assignment.
Yeah, so you should be able to get in that. Most of you have been on task forces before and know the drill. We want you to add your input, positive, negative, correcting, supplementing, you know, for each of the line items in the spreadsheet. When you do, please preface your remarks with some indication of your name. At least your last name, maybe a first initial would help too. And we'll do carriage returns between comments and try to kind of collect that information. And then we will use that to guide our discussions, as well as to develop the final recommendations. If anybody has any trouble getting to the documents, please, you know, let the co-chairs and or Mike know, and we'll get that addressed. Thank you to those of you who found the raise hand function. That's really helpful when we're doing these big meetings. So Eliel?
Yes, thanks, Stephen. I maybe missed a bit. I'm looking at the document, the deck that was sent by email. And we have the roster, and then we have the group's assignment. But I don't see my name and a few other people's name under the group's assignments.
So, Eliel, I see you in group one. Okay. I'm looking at slide 12 from today's materials.
Okay, that's good to know. But again, I guess I'm looking at the PowerPoint that was sent by email, and that doesn't seem to have all the details, but thanks. Okay.
The version I'm looking at has, you know, and maybe we can pop back up to slide 12 real quick before we dive into DSI. There we go. Here, this is the slide. Okay. I'm referring to. So everyone should be able to find themselves. Again, Jim has asked to join group two, so we'll tuck him in there as well. As you can see, people are in one, two, or three groups. And we're happy to accommodate if people want to do extra work. More than one. Phil?
Yeah, Steve, I was curious, are we allowing guest speakers in or?
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for that question. As usual, we will bring subject matter experts to discuss topics as appropriate. As task force members, you are welcome to recommend either areas of expertise or individuals to come. Some of us have already started doing that. I think that can be very helpful. Of course, we're going to have to be mindful of the time available. Let's actually slide up to slide 10 and just real quick remind people of the assignments. These are the multiple task items that we're going to address in group one. And then down on slide 11, you can see the groups two and three. So we have a lot to get through, but certainly, you know, let the leads know if there are individuals that you want to invite to the meetings, and we'll get on that.
Great, thank you.
Not seeing any other hands, I would say let's slide back down to slide 18. And Catherine and Jeff are going to walk us through the background materials around the DSI proposal, which are extensive. And then if we have the time, we'll jump into the proposals themselves.
Hey, Steve, one last question about the assignments for the various groups. Can we expect to get sort of information packages of the things we're supposed to review?
So yeah, the team has worked on that in the spreadsheet. If you scroll over to the right, and I don't know, Mike, if the team has the spreadsheet handy and can just sort of pop it up real quick since we're going there. There are numerous columns that include that information. One of the things that I've specifically asked the ONC to do is to pull out in a really handy, readable, highlightable, copyable format, you know, the specific sections of the 556 page rule that apply to each of the topics, so that people can assure that they have read all of the necessary information, both from the preamble and the body of the rule itself. I know that can be a real challenge. I'm sure that, you know, there's somebody on here who has not read every single page of the proposed rule to date and will want to be doing that kind of in a just-in-time way. And we want to assure that we support people in that.
What you propose, Steve, would be a gift.
Yeah. I think, Mike, can you give us any update on how that's coming along? I know they're working on it.
Do you want us to pull up the spreadsheet? Is that right, Stephen?
Well, no. That's, I mean, yeah, feel free to pull up the spreadsheet, but the question specifically had to do with, you know, as we were discussing in the email, the idea of pulling out the sections of the rule and putting them into a Word document, ideally, because that's going to give people the most flexibility that they could, you know, download and manipulate themselves to facilitate their review. Today, we obviously have the original published PDF version and the three-column view, neither of which, you know, is optimized for individual review.
Right. We are working on that. And the FEL team, you can let me share. I'll just pop the spreadsheet up quickly so that everyone can see it.
If that's going to take a while, okay, here we come. Great, there we go. So this is the spreadsheet. Again, the team has a lot of experience now. We've done this a number of times. As you can see, we've got, you know, the item to discuss, the date for discussion, which group number it's been assigned to. If you are going to, I think in column D, that's often where we put the name of the person who first starts the discussion. I'm not sure how important that is, frankly. So unless Mike, you feel otherwise, or Ike, I wouldn't worry about that one. The topic, the summary from the proposed rule obviously takes up a lot of space here. And then they have the specific page numbers where the reference is. So what our hope was to go from, you know, those page number references to the, you know, to actually have like a little Word document that's sitting there that you could open up and get to just what you're looking for. Because otherwise the hunting and finding and reviewing can be challenging. Member recommendations is where we want you to put your name and your ideas. Feel free to be brief. You can put URLs in there as needed. Justification. Again, I think the recommendations usually stand on their own. If you need to put in some other references, et cetera, feel free to use column I. And then as we discuss these items and pull together ideas, we will pop those into J. Here again, this is a great place to list any subject matter experts that should be invited. So this, you know, if you want to just pop it in there, as opposed to sending emails, that should be fine. And then we will craft our final recommendations in K. And then during that last week, we'll pull that into more of a prose document and pretty it up for, along with slides for presentation to the HITAC. Hung, if you're interested in joining the presentation and presenting the recommendations from group three, that would be welcome. We'll have a party there on June 15th. I don't think there's anything to the right of K, is there, Mike?
No.
Oh, great.
And I'll just add, Stephen, that these are broken down into the groups down the bottom here. There's three tabs so that you could find the topics depending on which group they're assigned with. So if somebody's working in a specific group, you really only need to focus on what's in that group, but obviously you can toggle back between these tabs or see what else is going on if you'd like.
And I can see we have a little bit of a data entry issue there, at least in one of them, the group number was in the task force member column. So we can clean that up a little bit. It was on the second tab. Yeah, that one, no big deal, not to worry. All right. Any other questions, Clem? Your hand is up. You're on mute, Clem. Okay, well, we can come back to Clem when he gets off mute. Let's jump back to the slides. We are a bit behind our aspirational schedule, I think. So let's jump in. Catherine, are you gonna take it away here?
Yes, no, thank you, Steve.
Hold on, Catherine. Clem was off mute momentarily. Clem, did you have a comment?
Yeah, some of those topics we've been through before at USD CDI version 3. Are we really going to rehash that again?
No. It's specifically the recommendation to change the standard for data exchange in various ONC rules from USCDI version 1 to USCDI.
Oh, okay, all right, I got it.
We're not going to be rehashing the USCDI itself. Okay, anything else, Clem? You're good? Great. All right, Catherine, take it away.
Great. No, thank you, Steve. Good morning, everyone. I'm Catherine Marcassini, the Chief Privacy Officer at ONC. So thank you, HITAC members, for inviting my ONC colleagues, Jeff Smith, and then later on, Jordan Everson, and I to share ONC's proposals, I would say, that intersect with data technology and decision support. And also, thank you for setting aside the time today and in future sessions as you're thinking through your comments. Next slide, please. Before I guess we dive in, you'll see here just kind of standard ONC disclaimer, but really just focusing on this isn't a legal document or advice, and you should review the underlying relevant laws and regulations for the particular proposals and the requirements. Next slide, please. You'll see a roadmap, kind of how we plan to discuss what as it relates to the topic and the proposals related to decision support interventions and predictive models over the first three meetings. We've tried to divide the content up into manageable areas. I know we're kind of going to do a lightning round today, but providing an initial overview and then setting up some initial background of the proposals and how it fits into the current state of the ONC Health IT Certification Program. Next slide, please. So jumping in, you'll see here at a very high level some of what is in the proposal. So ONC's proposal is an update to a longstanding requirements for decision support and transparency about that decision support. The proposed rule, as you'll see on the slide, it revises the existing clinical decision support certification criterion by proposing a decision support intervention certification criterion. So we'll talk a little bit more later, but it's a renaming and then an update. So we're looking at overall leveraging ONC's authorities. As many of you are familiar with, it is, regulating certified health IT, also known or commonly referred to as EHRs, to bring transparency into the relative quality of the predictive models as well, when those are used for decision making. And that is a broad definition, and I'll talk a little bit about that as it relates to healthcare. The proposal also includes a definition of predictive decision support intervention, and this includes AI, ML-driven decision support, as well as talking about, you'll hear the term, or say the acronym FAVES, fair, appropriate, valid, effective, and safe. That is, I would say, shorthand or kind of what we equate to as a high quality model. And also, you know, whether or not it's trustworthy. So overall, you know, you'll see here the proposals are, you know, are intended to compel a certified health IT to display information that would enable users to determine the quality of the predictive decision support intervention, and really trying to, I would say, you know, encourage, I hate to use the word compel, but really, you know, to require developers of certified health IT to employ, engage, and report public summaries of information as it relates to risk management practices. And this is often referred to as governance. You know, overall, this is going to be leveraging the existing ONC health IT certification program as it relates to real world testing. Next slide, please. So I would say today and in future meetings, you'll likely hear a lot about transparency, FAVES, and trust. And you'll see here, you know, I would say a kind of a bird's eye view. The proposal is really focused on, you know, improving transparency, enhancing trustworthiness, promoting consistency, and, you know, incentivizing the development and wider use of FAVES as it relates to, you know, a broader topic. Regarding predictive DSIs, but also advancing ONC's overall approach to health equity by design. We're hoping, or the intent is, that the resulting information transparency would enable users. So that's, you know, includes healthcare providers, clinicians, health hospital systems, health systems, to scrutinize and to really look into the technology so they're able to make, you know, informed decisions. And then overall, you know, would increase the public trust and confidence in these technologies. Next slide, please. So at a very high level, what technology are we talking about? You'll hear the term predictive decision support intervention, and you'll see on the slide the definition that's is proposed. Of note, just to call attention, the definition focuses on technology that makes estimates. Thinking, you know, outputs that are based on relationships learned and training data. So this is different, I would say, in contrast with the current certification criteria and scope that contrasts with evidence-based decision support interventions, which supports decision-making relying on predefined rules based on experts and, you know, the consensus in particularly around recommendations, for example, computable clinical guidelines. And this is not to say that predictive decision support wouldn't, you know, be based or, you know, could be based on evidence, but it really is focused on, you know, learning, you know, that happens throughout the process based on data. The other thing to kind of pinpoint is the definition does not depend on, I'd say, the who, the what, the where, and the why of the model. In that, you know, it can be developed by someone other than the certified developer, certified health IT developer, and it's not a use case dependent or determined or tied to a specific purpose. So this could be used for treatment, payment, healthcare operations, public health, research. And I say that, you know, for purposes of terms defined under HIPAA, for those that are familiar with that. But it also, you know, you can see some examples on the slide, but the technology also is not dependent on how the output is displayed or, you know, presents itself in the, you know, EHR. So it could be an alert, you know, an order set, flow sheet of that nature. Next slide, please. So I talked a little bit about the definition. The other kind of thing to focus on, or, you know, that the proposals include is, I would say, the premise that transparency is a prerequisite for trustworthy artificial intelligence. And you'll kind of see, you know, three pillars, if you will. You'll see here data transparency, predictive DSI transparency. So that's like technical and performance, as well as organizational transparency. Again, at a very high level, because we'll touch on this in later discussions, but for data transparency, just to call attention, this is really, includes the use of, or I should say, when the technology includes the use of race, ethnicity, and language, sexual orientation, gender information, and SDOH, as well as health status data elements, that is going to be as part of source attributes. And we'll talk a little bit about that later for the actual decision support intervention. You know, this information about that would be provided to users. And, you know, and the thinking is that this would greatly improve the possibility of identifying and mitigating, you know, any potential risks of employing both not only evidence-based, but also the predictive decision support interventions for patient care. And so this, you know, includes those related to exacerbating racial disparities, as well as promoting bias. The other kind of area I would say that is of interest, you'll see in the yellow, it's about the actual, I would say, predictive model and the technology itself. So this is really getting at the technical and the performance aspects or dimensions of the technology. And, you know, the next meeting of this group tomorrow, we'll spend a lot of time talking about that. But generally speaking, there are 14 areas across four categories that really focuses on the details. So the user understands that, you know, what was the intent for the model when it was designed, what data, you know, was used, how, you know, the model's maintained. And it is the proposed requirement is that this information be in plain language. And so that's, you know, just some big picture thinking, and, you know, we'll talk more about that tomorrow. The last kind of area or grouping focuses on organizational, as well as some refer to this as like the socio-technical dimensions or competencies. But this is actually, though, the organization here is referring to the developer, particularly the certified health IT developer. And the proposed requirement is that, you know, there are intervention risk management practices that are employed by the developers for the functional requirements, as it relates to the health IT module that enables or interfaces with the predictive decision support intervention. So to the extent there's a technology that meets the definition of predictive decision support interventions and it's enabled or interfaces with a health IT module, and there's also, you know, we'll talk a little bit about the intersection with the USCDI. If there is such a technology, this is a snapshot of what, you know, the requirements are and, you know, the intended kind of efforts or the outputs of that leading to trustworthy algorithms, particularly around predictive decision support. Next slide, please. And you'll see here, I touched on loosely the concept of FAVES, but, you know, there's kind of areas related to not only is it helpful for the individual and the users, the organization that is using the technology to make decisions. I talked about the scope, you know, it's not just about treatment, but it, you know, the benefit is to the user, they will have the information to make an informed decision about whether or not to apply a technology to a particular use case if it meets their needs. The other area to highlight here is really looking at the outputs and the activity, how it intersects with the work that industry and academia, as well as the public sector, are doing to develop means to communicate measures that they may be working on and other areas that they are, you know, diving into. We try to strike a balance to where the proposals are not overly prescriptive, but really trying to start the conversation about how to implement this in other areas of the certification criteria, adding on to our existing, I would say, requirement. And lastly, for the overall, you know, healthcare industry, it's really focusing on, you know, promoting the transparency necessary to encourage the development of a dynamic marketplace and really focusing on high quality models. As mentioned before, we kind of, for shorthand for FAVES. And again, we'll talk about that in a little bit on the next slides. With that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Jeff Smith, to share some of the background and context we included in the proposals related to decision support interventions and predictive models. Jeff?
Catherine, before we pass the baton, Ike has his hand up and we have a thoughtful comment in the chat. So maybe we'll just touch on those before we move on. Ike?
Thank you. And thank you for all your hard work. This is going to be a complicated question, I think. I'm sorry about that. I happen to have a really, really rare condition, one of about 1,000 people identified worldwide. The nature of the condition means that a lot of things that you might do for a person without the condition are really, really contraindicated for me. So what controls have we built into the system to identify where these supports should not be used in making a recommendation for a particular individual? That, for example, an intramuscular injection for me would literally fuse that joint and I would never be able to move it again. So that's not exactly an outcome that I or my PCP or any other healthcare provider really wants for me. How are we building into the system controls to identify where these things should not be used?
It's a great question. I guess initially, I know you'll see in the proposal under the source attributes, which we'll talk about tomorrow, there is I would say an area or an element or factor regarding, would say out of scope. There's also, the intent to include what I would say assumptions or factors or aspects or a problem that the tool was designed to solve. I think maybe a little bit of what I heard in your comment had to do with maybe some potential unintended consequences or areas where, to your point, like it should not be used. I will just share that the intent of the proposal is not about right now. It's not about the, ONC, about the safety and effectiveness of the technology, which is a little bit different than the FDA's kind of approach as it relates to medical devices. But it's not to say that information about that could not be provided as part of the requirement. And so I'll see if my colleagues, Jeff Smith or Everson, had anything else they wanted to add on that question.
And again, not a solution, because I don't have enough expertise to do that, but looking at something in the space of from a regulatory standpoint, hey, these tools should not be used in these circumstances or built into the framework, not as a matter of looking at specific safety requirements, because that, as you pointed out earlier, may be attached to a particular instance of a particular tool, but from a systemic way, looking at systemic support for enabling a non-use at the patient level becomes highly important. I work carefully with my PCP on making good medical decisions in that space. If I show up at the ER, I'm not working with a medical team that I work with on a more regular basis. They're not familiar with my medical history or my medical background, and might be in a position where they're more likely to use DSI and computer supports. I, as a patient, need protection built into the system that says, hey, based on this patient's core diagnosis pieces, these things don't do them, or don't rely on this algorithm to use recommendations, because this particular patient's fundamental measures are so outside the norm for getting a predicted value that you're not going to get a usable result.
Yeah, I think you're making a really good point. And I think this gets at the component of the predictive DSI transparency that is built into these recommendations. And obviously group two is going to have a chance to clarify this in comments. I'm a little sensitive to our timing. I see a couple of hands going up. Would anybody object strongly if we let the ONC team get through the presentation and hold the questions to the end? Clem, Hans, can you guys live with that, I hope? Yeah, let's go ahead, Catherine and Jeff, let's power on through this. I think some of the questions that are coming up may be answered by your presentation.
Okay, thanks, Stephen, and thanks all. Given the amount of time, I think what I'd like to do is for whoever's running the slides, can you skip ahead 6 slides? What we are going to be skipping through is a series of slides that articulate a series of blogs that we authored going back to the summer of last year. Really trying to, yeah, can we get two more slides? Yeah, sorry, there's some clicks in there. There we go, you can stop there. Go back one more, perfect. The blog series that we put through, that we published is vital for your understanding of where some of the background and context that we do include in the preamble. The preamble, as long as the DSI section is really important to give everyone a clear understanding that we're operating based on the best information and the latest peer-reviewed evidence that we were able to uncover and contextualize that within the authorities of ONC. So if you didn't read those blogs along the way, shame on you for not keeping up with our tremendous ONC Buzz blog. But more importantly, I think it would give you really important context as to the aspect of this space that we are focused on, which happens to be around decision support and the use of AI and ML technologies towards supporting that decision support. So I'm just going to start here with this. Happy to go through as much as we can, but also I recognize that we've got folks with questions. And so Stephen and Ike, you just let me know when I need to stop. And I'll keep my eye on the clock. It looks like we've got about 12 minutes. So I think for those of you who have been longtime admirers and fans of ONC's certification program, or maybe those of you who have just been regulated entities, you've probably known that we've had a certification criterion all the way back to ONC's program, Health IT Certification Program, in its inception, focused on CDS. It was actually mentioned in statute as part of a qualified electronic health record definition. And it essentially said that a qualified health electronic health record is a record of health related information that has the capacity to provide clinical decision support. So it's actually in statute. We took a number of steps to translate statute in the High Tech Act into kind of meaningful use related initial certification criteria. And what we ended up putting into regulation eventually was based on the Health IT Policy Committee's recommendations way back in 2012. And we included requirements that Health IT modules support CDS that does a number of things, including displaying source or citation of CDS, is configurable based on the patient context, is presented at a relevant point in clinical workflow, and includes alerts presented to users who can act on those alerts, and then is integrated with the EHR. So those were the recommendations that the HITPIC, Health IT Policy Committee, recommended to us back in 2012. If you could go to the next slide. So since 2012, a heck of a lot has happened, but not much of anything has happened in relation to our CDS criterion. So obviously, a lot of the background that was covered in those slides went into detail on how predictive models are increasingly being used and relied upon to inform a wide array of decision makers, including clinicians, payers, researchers, and individuals. And also one of the key things that we describe and discuss across those blogs is the role that Certified Health IT plays has become a central component both as a data source of these predictive models and as a delivery mechanism. And so again, we talk at some length around the centrality of certified health IT in both supporting the development and design of predictive DSIs, as well as serving as a vehicle to influence day-to-day decision-making. Okay, next slide. And one more. Okay, so we've got a series of slides here, and I don't think we'll be able to get through them in the 9 minutes that we've got, but we can go as far as we can. So I think a lot of folks had initially asked a question around why change the name? What is DSI? How does it compare to CDS? All very good questions. And I think the big takeaway is we're trying to modernize a certification criterion that is a decade old, and recognize that certified health IT plays a role in a greater variety of use cases. So the DSI concept expands on CDS to reflect the various and expanding forms of decision support that certified health IT modules enable or interface with. Increasingly, these use cases support across many aspects of healthcare, not just clinical workflow, but early detection of diseases, automated billing procedures, facilitating scheduling, and public health disease surveillance, among other use cases. So part of this reframing, part of this renaming is intended to really acknowledge this expanded set of use cases that certified health IT supports and adjust it for the future, where we anticipate certified health IT will continue to support numerous kinds of use cases outside of the traditional CDS workflows. Next slide. So here are some updates. I would say the traditional A9, and we do apologize in terms of using the federal Code of Federal Regulation citations, but I think it's going to be something that you'll get used to. So A9 is the CDS criterion. We are proposing to move that to B11, and this is important for a handful of reasons that we'll get into. But I think it's really important to know that if you're familiar with the structure of A9, you will be very familiar with the structure of B11 because we use A9 as really the base set of, we build on top of it and we build around it for B11. So we talk about how the new criterion and modules that certify to the new criterion will still be expected to enable evidence-based decision support, as well as linked referential decision support based on a defined set of data elements. And this has always been the case. Historically, we've required health IT modules to support CDS that uses problems, medications, allergies, demographics, labs, and vitals. We are now proposing that health IT modules also support CDS based on procedures and unique identifiers for implantable devices. We are also looking to expand on the existing set of source attribute information. We currently require that health IT modules provide users access to information, bibliographic information about the CDS. We also require that health IT modules provide users with developer information on the CDS or on the intervention and funding sources and the release or revision dates of the CDS, if applicable. That's all existing today. What we are proposing is that moving forward across all DSI types, that the health IT modules would also enable users to know if the intervention uses specific demographic data, if the intervention uses any social determinants of health data, and if the intervention uses any health status or assessment data. And across all of these data, we focus on US CDI. So if you have a question about what is health status and assessment or social determinants, we point to the US CDI as those data elements. And again, this is meant to provide users with transparency on what data elements are being used in that CDS. And this is, of course, something that a clinician is not required to look at, but this is something, or a user rather, is required to look at, but this is something a user may look at if they'd like to be able to look at it. And again, this builds on existing requirements for bibliographic information and developer and funding source. Yeah.
Jeff, before we go on to the proposed new requirements, why don't we pause? Because I think we've got a couple of task force members with questions and we want to be on time for the public comment. So Clem, you had your hand up for quite some time. Did you have a question you wanted to put out? If not, Hans?
Thank you, Stephen. Question that I have, and it ties a little bit to Devin's question as well, so I'll point to her for that part. But with DSI that spans a variety of HIT that potentially can offer that, and the examples that have been used go into scheduling, operations, other topics where there can be value to that. What's ONC's intent from HIT that should be certified to these capabilities beyond EHRs? There's a clear understanding in that space, but there's also HIT that are not considered EHRs where this would apply. How are you looking at that? And I think, Devin, your question might be tied to that as well with other places in that space that you had in the chat.
It might be helpful to jump down to a slide. So can you go forward four slides? One more. So Hans, this is something that I think probably we'll spend a lot of time, or we'll spend more time on this this slide and the concepts contained in this slide, and we do provide additional information obviously in the preamble. I think the easiest way to try and answer that question is to point out that we regulate certified health IT and certified health IT modules. We really don't think in terms of EHRs. So there's going to have to be a conceptual common ground, knowing that obviously there are entities out there that are very much thinking to themselves, we are an EHR company, or we provide EHRs. And so at a kind of basic level, we have health IT modules that are certified to certain criteria. And I think the answer to the question, I think kind of understanding the scheduling software use case, the real nexus that we've got in the certification program and that we're proposing for this and the predictive decision support intervention definition is that the health IT module, if it enables or interfaces with a predictive model, and I'll boil it down to that just a little bit. If it enables or interfaces with a predictive model, then the predictive model or the DSI would be subject to our requirements. There's some further caveats there because we do not regulate algorithms out in the wild. We regulate certified health IT. And so when we get into the conversation around source attributes, it's important to recognize that we look at the world in terms of which predictive DSIs are developed by certified health IT developers themselves and predictive DSIs that are developed by other parties. And so the requirements that we're proposing would be in some ways absolute for developers of certified health IT that develop DSI, predictive DSIs. And then we would rely on existing, essentially existing requirements around CDS. So if you're a health IT developer that uses CDS that's developed by a different organization, or maybe it's developed by the, sorry. So anyway, this slide is going to be one that we'll probably want to focus on quite a lot and get your feedback on. And I'll stop there.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. We actually are going to transition to public comment. If we have time left, we'll come back to Clem, Devin, and Hannah in that order.
All right, everybody, we're going to open up our meeting for public comment. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you happen to be on the phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. So let's pause this for a moment to see if any members of the public raise their hand. Not seeing any hands raised, I'll turn it back to you, Stephen.
All right. And Cheryl, I know you've been very, very patient. Did you have anything you wanted to toss in since I can't see your hand raised?
Thank you, Stephen. I did want to say that with the point that was brought up earlier, and I will definitely want to talk about this in the small group, it was a concern of mine as well, ensuring that predictive models address rare and other conditions, because we look to what are the factors for health equity, what are the factors for specific types of conditions, but already in the way we look at cost data, which has decision modeling around it, they've pretty much done away with paying for testing for vitamin D. But if you're a vitamin D resistant rickets patient, you need that vitamin D test, and they don't pay for it today because there's no variation that happens in the decision support, unfortunately. So I do think we have examples in today's world that show that this is an area that we particularly need to pay attention to, and we need to make sure that the right guardrails and governance is there around that, and to the extent that it impacts sort of that by health IT. I know that this is not the area where we're going to be implementing, what should be there and what shouldn't be, but there should be at least some guardrails relative to the governance of how these things are implemented that we should be able to recommend. So with that, I'm very happy to be part of this group and look forward to our recommendations.
Thank you, Cheryl. Again, we've got 8 minutes left. We're going to end on time. We got three hands up. Clem?
Well, very quickly, I think we should not put decision support on too high a pedestal. It is not perfect. There's all kinds of issues and problems. And we're talking as though it's a done deal. And all we do is someone cooks up a rule and everything's going to be perfect. It won't be. So just be wary.
Thank you for that wise observation. Devin?
So I'm trying to get a handle on what the incentives are to purchase a module from a certified EHR vendor that has been certified to these criteria, and what are the incentives for the HIT developers to certify modules, whether they are homegrown, self-developed, or whether they are add-ons from additional vendors. Because, and it could be that I'm just, my knowledge of sort of how the, where the incentives are to sort of utilize certified modules and the authorities that ONC has is a little rusty. But given that we've sort of, not every piece of a certified, where's the incentive for certification, I should say? I mean, I think, Jeff, you get the answer to my question. The prior slide didn't really answer it because it didn't say to me that any sort of certified EMR vendor would necessarily be required to certify a module, or maybe they are. And if so, I'd like to have that underscored. But then where is the customer incentive to actually purchase a module?
Yep.
Like, I'm not aware of any financial incentives to use DSI that's been certified, for example. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Great question, Devin. So to the first question on whether or not health IT developers are required to support predictive DSIs, the answer to that is no. We've constructed the criterion to be conditional. So if there is a developer who is certified currently today to A9 and they have no ambitions or plans to enable or interface with DSI, predictive DSIs, then they won't have to go through many of the requirements that are predictive DSI specific, and there's no obligation to certify to B11 and support and do so supporting predictive DSIs. And we can get into the conditional nature of the criterion, but that was built in because we don't want to force that. To your other question around incentives, also a good question. The incentive here is that, and I may have glossed over this in our haste, but I mentioned that clinical decision support is a part of what was the original statutory definition for a qualified EHR. We have translated the statutory definition for qualified EHR as part of into what we call the base EHR definition. And so as of today, you cannot be a certified health IT module, or you cannot meet the base requirement for certified health IT without being certified to the clinical decision support criterion, which is say A9. And moving forward, we have proposed to include B11 as part of the base EHR definition. So therein lies the incentive. It will be a kind of baseline requirement for any module or product that wants to meet the baseline EHR definition.
Got it. But there aren't any concomitant requirements on the part of users of the IT to use those when they do their if they're going to deploy predictive algorithms. They don't necessarily have to use what's offered in there. We don't have any incentives for them to use what's certified versus something else.
Well, certainly there are requirements under CMS payment policy to use a base EHR definition.
To use a base EHR, but not particular to decision support.
Decision support is part of the base EHR definition. And so again,
right.
There wouldn't be requirements for users to use predictive DSIs, for instance.
And yet, Devin, it seems that there may be some market advantage to be offering certified predictive DSI. Time will tell.
Yeah, of course. But this was helpful clarification on where this sits in terms of both the users' incentives to use it as well as developers' incentives to provide it. Thank you.
So Hannah, you've been very patient with your hand up. Anna and Hans, I've noted your questions. I think we may end up coming back to them tomorrow. But Hannah, do you want to get your question out there?
Thanks. I'll be very brief. Just while we think about transparency, as someone who implements these types of models, I would think about how we are transparent to those who are implementing the model, say a CMIO or an implementation team, versus the transparency to a provider at the bedside. What does a provider at the bedside need to know? To Ike's point, I have a patient in front of me with a rare condition and I need to understand how the model was built and is it appropriate for this patient, versus the transparency of, you know, is there bias in this model, right? That may need to dig deeper. What type of population was this tested on, right? And what type of transparency is needed sort of in both situations, which may be the same thing, it may not be the same thing, right? And keeping provider burden in mind, there's only sort of so much that a provider at the bedside can sort of dig into a model. I would also sort of keep in mind, right, and I did go back and review the slides to my previous question, that we are encompassing more advanced neural networks in this process. And as we think about bias, thinking about the data that's being fed into those neural networks is not necessarily understanding how that's being used, right? And so that's a start to understand sort of what pieces of data are being fed in, but it's not quite the same thing as understanding the algorithm. And so when we do have a black box problem there and not understanding kind of how the data is being used, there's sort of only so much that we can understand in terms of the potential bias of the potential algorithms. So I think there are some pieces there that I want to sort of further understand how the decision support capabilities will be required to provide that information to better assess bias for those who are implementing this as part of certified EHR technology.
Thank you so much, Hannah. And we're going to let that be the last word today. We are going to pick up this topic as well as Anna and Hans raised hands when Group 2 meets tomorrow. Any of you who want to continue the discussion there, let's meet then. And I anticipate that everyone will have a chance to review the slides in detail to spare us the time of making ONC go through those. And we will pick up the conversation and questions at that time. Anything to add, Ike or Mike?
No, sir. I look forward to seeing folks tomorrow and continuing our work.
Excellent. Everybody have a great day.
Thank you.